one of the commentaries, and I'd gotten so many of them when I was teaching Pilgrim's Progress Part 1, was by George Beryl Cheever about the year 1856. And it was one of my more favorite commentaries. And he didn't spend a lot of time on Part 2 of Pilgrim's Progress, but he said if only the second part of the Pilgrim's Progress had been written, it may well be doubted whether it would not have been regarded in a higher light than it is now. The first part is so superior to the second that this loses in the comparison and gains not so much admiration as it really deserves. Just so, the Paradise Regained would have been esteemed a nobler poem had it not stood after the Paradise Lost, the splendor of John Milton's genius in the first effort quite eclipsed its milder radiance in the second. However, the second part of Pilgrim's Progress is full of instruction and beauty and exhibits varieties of the Christian life delineated with such truth, both to nature and grace, that though there is less elevation both in thought and style, and more familiarity and homeliness, we are still delighted with our journeyings and love to listen to the voice of our accustomed teacher. There is not such purity and severity of taste, not such glowing fire of sentiment and feeling, not such point and condensation, not such unity and power in the second part as in the first. The conversations do not possess the same richness and fullness of meaning, nor do the same deep, solemn, blissful tones of warning of heaven. There is sometimes almost all the difference that is found between the garrulity of men at ease and the earnest, thoughtful talk of men pondering great themes and set upon great enterprises. So what he's saying in short is that the characters, their manifestations of their conduct and so on, is more really like most of us experience in our Christian life. It doesn't have the warfare and the valley of the shadow of death and some of the things that the first part does, but for that reason alone it is also instructive, because most of us can more identify with Christiana than we could with Christian. In fact, in our day, and people that I've talked to don't talk a lot about having gone through a slough of despond prior to entering into Wicket Gate. So I wanted to show you a picture here that I found interesting when I was teaching Pilgrim's Progress, the first edition. This is actually a copy of the very first edition. I understand that there may only be one left in the world from 1678, and that's in the British Museum. But it has always caught my eye and been interesting to see what's written down here at the bottom, because it says it's printed for Nathaniel Ponder at the Peacock in 1678. And most people would miss the significance of that, but the significance is that there had been a friendship that had formed between John Owen, who lived from 1616 to 1683 and one of the princes of the Puritans, and John Bunyan, who was in the Bedford jail. And Owen got a copy of the original Pilgrim's Progress, and he read it. As he read it, he thought, there's instruction here. This is really pretty good. Well, Nathaniel Ponder is the actual publisher for the works of John Owen. And what you learn from this is, if it wasn't for John Owen, as some people said, he was never short of a penny. He was pretty well-to-do. In fact, he was a chaplain in the 17th century, and also in some favor with Charles II. Well, few Puritans really were. And so Owen funded the original Pilgrim's Progress, and I believe the second volume that came out in 1684, by that time Bunyan was out of prison, and there was already such a notoriety of the first version of Pilgrim's Progress. I don't know how it was funded, but I would think by that time Bunyan would have had the notoriety. This work was well enough known that the funding would have been there for Volume 2. So it starts off with a character named Mr. Sagacity. So Bunyan claims in his fiction that he's been wanting to get to the original place where he dreamed, and the first dream resulted in the story of Christian and Pilgrim's Progress. And he had been waylaid, he had been sidetracked. Providentially, he wasn't able to get down there. But he makes a visit there, and it says he dreams again. And Robert McGuire says the first part of the Pilgrim's Progress had been written in the jail of Bedford. The second part was produced a few years later when it would appear Bunyan was again a free man and residing in his native village of Elstow in England, which is about a mile off the place in which the former part had been indicted. And Wikipedia says the second part of the Pilgrim's Progress presents the pilgrimage of Christian's wife, Christiana, their sons, and the maiden, Mercy. They visit the same stopping places that Christian visited, with the addition of Gaius's Inn between the Valley of the Shadow of Death and Vanity Fair. But they take a longer time in order to accommodate marriage and childbirth for the four sons and their wives. The hero of the story is Greatheart, a servant of the interpreter who is a pilgrim's guide to the Celestial City. He kills four giants called Giant Grim, Giant Maul, Giant Slaygood, and Giant Despair, and participates in the slaying of a monster called Legion that terrorizes the city of Vanity Fair. The passage of years in the second pilgrimage better allegorizes the journey of the Christian life. By using heroines, more female figures, Bunyan in the second part illustrates the idea that women as well as men can be brave pilgrims. Now, part two of Pilgrim's Progress, which appeared in 1684, is much more than a mere sequel to or repetition of the earlier volume. It clarifies and reinforces and justifies the story of part one. The beam of Bunyan's spotlight is broadened to include Christian's family and other men, women, and children. The incidents and accidents of everyday life are more numerous. The joys of the pilgrimage tend to outweigh the hardships, and to the faith and hope of part one is added in abundant measure that greatest of virtues, charity. So again, Christian meets up with Sagacity, and Sagacity is going to recount the story of Christian and Pilgrim's Progress, because in their conversation, the conversation of Christian comes up. And we'll get into that in a minute, but the thing that struck me as I'm reflecting on this is that since Christian had already gone to the Celestial City, he would not have been aware of his wife Christian and the four sons later on receiving mercy. Well, as a typical Christian father and somebody that cared deeply for his family, you know that he would have prayed incessantly for this family to be converted, but he didn't see that in his lifetime. So I want to tell you a story to give you encouragement that those that you sometimes pray for and you don't see them come to Christ, that's not the end of the story, even if it's the end of your life story. In a book I got years ago, is probably the first book I had ever narrated when I started narrating in 1985 by Archibald Alexander, called Practical Truths, is a story called An Answer to Prayer Long Deferred or Delayed. And he says, half a century past, a writer was accustomed to frequent places of worship, where the houses were situated in a grove, or rather in the midst of the trees of a dense forest and far from any human habitation. On a certain occasion, when the Lord's Supper was about to be solemnized in one of these humble churches, I went early that I might avoid the conversation and dust of the multitude on the road. So he's arriving to this place where they're going to celebrate the Lord's Supper. He gets there early, which would give him an opportunity of solitary meditation under the trees which encompassed the house of prayer. And so Alexander is a young pastor here. He thought, surely that I should be first on the ground, but I was mistaken. I saw an elderly gentleman who had just secured his horse to a bough of a tree, or bough of a tree, coming towards the house to meet me. And upon his coming near me, I recognized an old acquaintance. He had known him before, at whose house I had lodged in my journeyings more than once. He had formerly been an elder in a Presbyterian church. As I believed him to be a very pious man, well-informed and zealous for the truth, I was pleased to meet with him and hold communion with him. After some general remarks, we got upon the subject of the efficacy of prayer. Thank you so much. And as I was young and he was an aged and experienced man, I was glad to throw the burden of the conversation on him. And that's enjoyable. You get somebody that's been in the way a long, long time, somebody that's been walking with the Lord a long time, and you can draw them out and hear how the Lord has dealt with them. And that's very edifying for a young Christian. And as he was not unwilling to speak on a subject which seemed to be near his heart, in the course of our conversation, he related to me a piece of his own experience. He said that his oldest son, who was a lawyer of some eminence, had as unblemished a moral character as any man in the land, and yet, though respectful to religion, he never had manifested any serious concern about his own salvation. But, and this is the old man talking, I have had such nearness to God and such liberty in prayer for his conversion that I believe those prayers will be answered in due time, whether I live to see it or not. Indeed, he said, on one occasion I am persuaded that God gave me an assurance that my prayers in his behalf would be answered. So he's saying, I believe that God has given me an assurance that in his time he's going to grant the prayer request for the salvation of my son. And so Alexander, the young pastor, is reflecting on this, and he says, I confess, this appeared to me somewhat like enthusiasm, but I made no reply. And soon our conversation was terminated by the gathering of the people. I thought, however, that I would remember this manner and from time to time make inquiry respecting the person whose conversion was so confidently expected by his father. Soon after this, the old elder was gathered to his fathers and died in faith and in peace. But residing far from his abode, I don't know the particular exercises of his mind as he approached the borders of the other world. For some years I forgot the conversation and made no inquiry, but some person who was acquainted with the family informed me that after his father's death, this son fell into habits of intemperance. That in fact he became a mere sot, remaining at home and stupefying himself with alcoholic drinks every day. Such a case appeared to me nearly hopeless. I had seldom known a man thus brought under the power of strong drink to recover himself. I now thought that the good old father had been deluded by a lively imagination. And for many years every report respecting the son seemed to render the case more hopeless. But behold the truth and faithfulness of a prayer-hearing God. See an example of the efficacy of fervent and importunate prayer. Though the answer was long deferred, this man, after continuing in intemperate habits until the age of 70 or more, has recently been completely reclaimed and not only delivered from that vice, but soundly converted to God. He not only gives evidence of a change, but appears to be imminent in the practice of piety. If he is now living, and I have not heard of his decease, he must be about 80 years of age. How wonderful are the ways of God! His faithfulness never fails. It reaches to the clouds. Your faithfulness is unto all generations. Oh, that men would praise the Lord for his goodness and for his wonderful works to the children of men. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. Habakkuk 2, verse 3. Let pious parents learn never to give over praying for their unconverted children, however hopeless the case may seem to be, for God will in faithfulness hear their supplications and answer them sooner or later in one way or another. And so, Christian obviously did not see the conversion of his wife and his four boys, but obviously it would have been upon his lips and in his heart. But it was deferred until after his death. So, Christian is having this dream and he's talking to Mr. Sagacity and he says, I saw an elderly gentleman come by where I was staying. And because he was going part of the way I was traveling, I thought I would get up and go with him. As we walked, it seemed as though we fell into conversation, as travelers usually do. And our talk happened to be about Christian and his travels. So I said to the old man, Sir, What's that town down there to the left of our path? That's the city of destruction, said Mr. Sagacity, for that was his name. It's a populous place, but full of ill-mannered and idle sort of people. I thought that was the place, I said. I went through that town myself once and can vouch for the truth of what you say of it. Sagacity said, only too true. I wish I would be telling the truth if I spoke better of the people who live there. Well, sir, I said, I can see you're a kindly intentioned man who likes to hear and tell what's good. Tell me, did you ever hear of a man called Christian who went on a pilgrimage some time ago from this town towards the higher regions? Sagacity said, hear of him, I should say so. And I also heard of all the attacks, the troubles, the battles, the captivities, the cries and the groans and the frights and the fears that he met with on his journey. Besides, I have to tell you that our whole country rings of him. But tell me, sir, while it's still fresh in my mind, do you hear anything of his wife and children? Poor things, I wonder what they are doing now. Who? Christiana and her sons? They're likely to do as well as Christian himself, though they acted foolishly at first and refused to be convinced either by Christian's tears or his pleading. Second thoughts have had a wonderful effect on them, so they packed up and gone after him. So he tells the full story, and then he's going to enter into more of the details that led up to them becoming pilgrims. And as they became pilgrims, this lady, Christian's wife, her name is now Christiana. Better and better, I said, but do you mean wife and children and all? Sagacity said, it's true. I can give you an account of it, for I was on the spot at that very time and was thoroughly acquainted with the whole affair. So I presume we can take it as true, I said. You needn't be afraid to tell anyone. What I mean is the good woman and her four boys have indeed all gone on pilgrimage, and as I notice, we're going a good way together. I'll give you an account of the whole affair. After her husband had gone over the river, Christiana, for that was her name from the day she and her children took themselves off to the pilgrim life, began to have serious thoughts at work on her mind. First, that she had lost her husband, and the living bond between them was broken. For you know, said Mr. Sagacity, it's only natural for deep thoughts to weigh on the minds of the living when they remember the loss of their loving relationships. The loss of her husband therefore cost her many a tear. But that was not all. Christian began to reflect whether her unkind conduct towards her husband was one reason she saw him no more, and whether in some way that was why he had been taken from her. And on top of this, all her unkind and natural and ungodly attitudes to her dear friend came swarming into her mind, filling her conscience and weighing her down with guilt. Moreover, the memory of her husband's groans, his salty tears and self-reproach, and the way she hardened her heart against all his pleading and loving efforts to persuade her and her sons to go with him, broke her heart. Yes, there was nothing Christian said to her or did before her. All the time his burden was hanging on his back that did not come back on her like a flash of lightning and tear her apart. That bitter cry of his especially, what shall I do to be saved, rang mournfully in her ears. Well, anybody that gives you a commentary comparing Christian in part one and Christiana in part two will say that Christian had a more of an awakening, what we have discussed in this class before, a law work, that his convictions were pungent, they were overwhelming, and so on. And we suppose that fact by the view of that burden on his back weighing him down, and how he never even got rid of that burden until he had got through the house of the interpreter and got a view of the cross on the other side. So that burden upon his back doubtless represents the conviction that he had of sin. But a lot of that conviction could be mere legal conviction and not evangelical conviction. It can be the fear of the wrath of God because you're a great sinner without feeling evangelical sorrow for your sin. And if you look at Christiana, and if she reflects on what she had done, if you remember in part one, she said to her husband, why don't you go to bed and maybe it'll settle your brains. And if you look at her reflections upon what she had done to him, you see that there was, in fact, a deeper, more evangelical sorrow for her sins. So it's not outward appearance that in and of itself could give you a proper view of what's going on in the heart and side of the convicted sinner. So Robert McGuire, commenting on anything of his wife and children, said, "This question introduces the details of the second pilgrimage. Christiana had resisted conviction during the whole period of her husband's lifetime. His death, when he had gone over the river, awakened her conscience to a sense of her own sin and of her guilt in joining hand in hand with the ungodly to resist good Christians' desires for heaven and his earnest efforts to attain it." So the next thing that happens is Christiana has, it's either two or three dreams. Each one is a little different. "It seemed that a broad parchment was spread before her eyes, on which was written a full record of all her past ways, and those times looked to be very black. In her sleep, she cried out, 'God, have mercy on me, a sinner.' And the children all heard her. At this point, she thought she saw two very unpleasant-looking persons standing beside her bedside, saying, 'What shall we do with this woman? She's crying out awake and asleep for mercy. If she's allowed to go on like this, we'll lose her as we've lost her husband. One way or another, we have to try and take her thoughts off what will happen hereafter, or else nothing in the world will stop her becoming a pilgrim.' Christiana woke up sweating profusely and trembling, but soon she fell asleep again." So she's having a second dream. "In her sleep, she thought she saw her husband in a place of bliss among many immortals, with a harp in his hand, as was standing, playing it before someone who was sitting on a throne, with a rainbow about his head. She also saw him as if he bowed with his face to a pavement beneath his prince's feet, saying, 'I thank my Lord and King from the bottom of my heart for bringing me into this place.' Then the company of those who were standing around shouted and played on their harps, but no one alive could tell what they were saying except Christian and his companions." So as I'm reflecting on these things, and as this is going through my mind, and the reflections we often have, and I don't look forward to going through this, I can say for sure that should our mate pass away and we're vexing ourselves and sorrowing for the things that we said that shouldn't have been said, and the things that we did that we wish we hadn't done. It reminded me, I got here in December of 1988, and I was checking out the local radio stations, and one of the songs that was playing continually was a hit that year by a band called Mike and the Mechanics. And Mike, it turned out, I looked this up, was a bass player for a band called Genesis. But they formed their own band, and this song was called In the Living Years, and we'll see if we can get through this without a lot of tears, but it's an amazing lyric focusing upon his father passing away, and he had let things not get healed between them. So he says, "I wasn't there that morning when my father passed away. I didn't get to tell him all the things I had to say. I think I caught his spirit later that same year. I'm sure I heard his echo in my baby's newborn tears. I just wish I could have told him in the living years. Say it loud, say it clear. You can listen as well as you hear. It's too late when we die to admit we don't see eye to eye. Say it loud, say it clear. You can listen as well as you hear. It's too late when we die to admit we don't see eye to eye." So going on, the next night Christiana had a dream. Robert McGuire says, "It seemed that a broad parchment was spread before her eyes, on which was written a full record of all her past ways. And those times looked very black. In her sleep, she cried out, 'God, be merciful to me, a sinner.'" So as she wakes and she's reflecting all of these things, she communicates to her children who are quite affected by their mother crying out and so on. And it says, now I saw in my dream that the old gentleman himself, and that's sagacity, seemed to be greatly moved by his story as he told it to me. However, he continued and said, so Christiana called her sons together and began to speak of them as follows. My sons, as you can see, I've been deeply concerned in my soul of late about the death of your father, though it's not because I have any doubts about his happiness, for I'm satisfied now that all is well with him. I've also been affected by thoughts about my own condition and yours, which I really believe is naturally wretched. My attitude toward your father in his distress is also a great burden on my conscience, for I hardened my own heart and yours against him and refused to go with him on his pilgrimage. Thoughts like these would kill me but for a dream I had last night and an announcement this stranger has brought me this morning. So let's pack up, children, and be off to the gate that leads to the celestial city. So what was that she had? There was a person that knocked at the door named Secret, who said that he had heard of her desires for mercy, that it had been told abroad in the eternal world, and he came and said, I have a letter from your husband's king. And it was written in letters of gold and had an invitation to her. And so she was really interested in the whole subject. She had woke up sweating profusely and trembling, but as she fell asleep again and saw her husband in a place of bliss, she almost thought there was no hope for her. But thankfully, this man named Secret came to her. And she was kind of embarrassed at what he was saying to her, and she bowed with her face on the ground. But the visitor said, there's a letter here for you, which I brought from your husband's king. And she took it and opened it, and it smelled of the sweetest perfume. And the letters were letters of gold, and an invitation was to her that if you will follow me as your husband did, you still can have mercy. And she was so taken back by that. She was so hopeful at that. But she actually asked Secret, please and take me with you. Take us with you so that we can see Christian. And Secret said, no, there must be a time of suffering before you can have that end of your journey. So she made up her mind that it was time to leave, that she was going to be a pilgrim, that there was yet mercy for her, and she wanted to set out on this journey. But as they were about to leave, two of the women who were Christian's neighbors came up to the house and knocked on the door. And she said to them, as she had said before, if you come in God's name, come in. The women were stunned to hear this, for they were not used to this kind of language or to hear it from the lips of Christiana. So they knew her, they were neighbors, and this was new language for them. Still, they came in, and what did they see but Christiana getting ready to leave her house. And she was earnest. She was ready to go. She was not going to be delayed. Her mind was made up, and the children were rejoicing so much, and they broke out in exclamations of joy because mother wanted to follow on so that they could see their father. Well, this lady, the first one, and there were two, there was Timorous and there was Mercy, but Timorous was actually the daughter of a Timorous who had been going in the other direction from the hill difficulty in Pilgrim's Progress Part 1, who was afraid to make this journey. He tried to make him go back for fear of the lions, Timorous had said in the first part. For what journey, may I ask, Christiana? And Christiana says to Timorous, to follow my husband. With that, she started weeping. Oh, I hope not, neighbor. For your poor children's sake, don't throw yourself away in such an unwomanly manner. No, my children are all coming with me, and not one of them is willing to stay behind. So speaking of Timorous, Alexander White, who died in the year 1921, had three volumes of commentary on the characters in Pilgrim's Progress Part 2 and the Holy War. So speaking of Timorous, says, well, to begin with, Mrs. Timorous was not a bad woman, as women went in that town and in that day. Her companions, her gossips, as she would have called them, were far worse women than she was. And had it not been for her family infirmity, had it not been for that timid, hesitating, lukewarm, and half-and-half habit of mind, which she had inherited from her father, the one that Christian met on Hill Difficulty, there is no saying what part she might have played in the famous expedition of Christiana and Mercy and the boys. Her father had been a pilgrim himself at one time, but he had now for a long time been known in the town as a turncoat and a temporary, and all his children had unhappily taken after their father in that. Had her father held on as he at one time had begun, had he held on in the face of all fear and all danger as Christiana's noble husband had done, to a certainty his daughter would have started that morning with Christiana and her company, and would have been, if a timid, easily scared, and troublesome pilgrim, yet as a true pilgrim, and made as welcome at last as, say, Miss Much Afraid, Mr. Fearing, and Mr. Ready to Halt were made. But her father's superficiality and shakiness, and at bottom his warm love of this world and his lukewarm love of the world to come, had unfortunately all descended to his daughter, till we find her actually reviling Christiana on that decisive morning and returning to her dish of tea and tittle-tattle with Mrs. Bat-Sighs and Mrs. Inconsiderate and Mrs. Light-Mind and Mrs. Know-Nothing. From Pilgrim's Progress, Timorous, I really wonder who or what has put this into your head, Christiana. My dear neighbor, if only you knew as much as I do, I've no doubt you'd come with me. Tell me, I pray, what new knowledge do you have that turns your mind against your friends and tempts you to set off nobody knows where? Then Christiana replied, I've been terribly distressed since my husband left me, but especially since he went over the river. But the thing that troubles me most is my ungracious attitude to him when he was distressed himself. Besides, I'm now as he was then. Nothing will stop me going on pilgrimage. I was dreaming last night that I saw him. Oh, how I wish my soul were with him. He lives in the presence of the king of the country. He sits and eats with him at his table. He has become a companion of immortal beings and has been given a house to live in, compared with which the finest palace on earth seems to be a mere garbage dump. The prince of that place has also sent for me, promising, if I come, to entertain me. His messenger was here just now, secret, and brought me a letter inviting me to come. With that, she took out the letter, read it, and said to them, what do you say to that? So White's saying on this, the thing that positively terrified Mrs. Timorous at the very thought of setting out with Christiana that morning was that intolerable way in which Christiana had begun to go back upon her past life as a wife and a mother. Christiana could not hide her deep distress, and indeed she did not much try. Such were the swarms of painful memories at her husband's late death. The visit of secret and the one thing and another had let loose upon Christiana's mind that she could take pleasure in nothing but in how she was to escape away from her past life and how she could in any way mend it and make up for it where she could not escape from it. You may judge yourself, said Mrs. Timorous to Mr. Lightmind, whether I was likely to find much entertainment with a woman like that. For Mrs. Timorous, too, you must know, had a past life of her own, and it was that past life of hers, all brought back by Christiana's words that morning, that made Mrs. Timorous so revile her old friend and return to the society we so seen her with. Now, is it not this the case, that we all have swarms of evil memories that we dare not face? There is no single relationship in life that we can boldly look back upon and fully face. As soon, or as a daughter, as a brother, or as a sister, a friend, a lover, a husband, a wife, a minister, as a member, as master, as a servant, what swarms of hornet memories darken our hearts as we look back upon how we had treated them, how we communed with them. Let any grown-up man with some imagination, tenderness of heart, and integrity of conscience go back step by step, taking some time to it at a new year, say, or a birthday, or some such suitable occasion. Let him go over his past life back to his youth and childhood, and what an intolerable burden will be laid on his heart before he is done. What a panorama of scarlet pictures will pass before his inward eye. What a forest of accusing fingers will be pointed at him. What hissing curses will be spat at him, both by the lips of the living and the dead. What untold pains he will see that he has caused to the innocent and the helpless. What desolating disappointments, what shipwrecks of hope to this man and to that woman. What a stone of stumbling he has been to many who on that stone have been forever broken and lost. What a rock of offense even his mere innocent existence, all unknown to himself till afterwards, has been. Swarm, said Christiana. So then Christiana replied, I've been terribly distressed since my husband left me, but especially since he went over the river. But the things that troubles me most is my ungracious attitude to him when he was distressed himself. In Ezekiel 36, verse 22, it says, therefore say to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, it is not for your sake, O house of Israel, that I'm about to act, but for my holy name, which you have profaned among the nations where you went. I will vindicate the holiness of my great name, which has been profaned among the nations, which you have profaned in their midst. Then the nations will know that I am the Lord, declares the Lord God, when I prove myself holy among you in their sight. For I will take you from the nations, gather you from all the lands, and bring you into your own land. Then I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean. I will cleanse you from all your filthiness and from all your idols. Moreover, I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you, and I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give to you an heart of flesh, and I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and so on. So of Christiana's repentance and evangelical sorrow, William Greenhill, in his commentary on Ezekiel, there is a legal tenderness which arises from apprehensions of God's sovereignty and justice, and I believe Christian had that, and you saw that with that burden upon his back that was so overwhelming. The fact that he knows that wrath is due him for his sin and his sinful practices, whereupon they humble themselves, mourn, sigh, weep, and pray, and so manifest some tenderness of heart. Such, I conceive, was the tenderness of Manasseh's heart when he was among thorns, bound in fetters, and in affliction. But a legal tenderness never loves God, it loves itself, and seeks itself. But evangelical or spiritual tenderness carries out the heart to God and Christ. A tender heart dare not go out from God in any case, but commits itself anyway to him. It consults with God and leans upon him for counsel and direction. Josiah, when the law was found, and he understood from it what wrath was due to the breach of it, he sends men to inquire of him. Then you will remember your evil ways and your deeds that were not good. Quoting Ezekiel, and you will loathe yourselves in your own sight for your iniquities and your abominations. When God brings his people out of Babylon into Canaan, out of the world in anti-Christian ways into near relation to himself and into gospel order, then he will frame their spirit so that they shall review their former ways and be ashamed of them. And sometimes this happens later in life. And sometimes the conversion could be later in life. And in the narrative of surprising conversions by Jonathan Edwards, when he brings the particulars down to two people, one of them we spoke of before, Phoebe Bartlett, who was converted at the age of 4, there was also a lady named Abigail Hutchinson. And I'll tell you the story in closing. She was first awakened in the winter season on Monday by something she heard her brother say of the necessity of being in good earnest and seeking regenerating grace, together with the news of the conversion of the young woman before mentioned, whose conversion so generally affected most of the young people here. So the older lady is being affected by the story of the young girl, Phoebe Bartlett, who was converted at the age of 4. This news wrought much upon her and stirred up a spirit of envy in her towards a younger woman whom she thought very unworthy of being distinguished from others by such mercy. But with it, it engaged her to a firm resolution to do her utmost to obtain the same blessing. Considering with herself what course she should take, she thought that she had not a sufficient knowledge of the principles of religion to render her capable of conversion, whereupon she resolved thoroughly to search the scriptures, and accordingly immediately began at the beginning of the Bible. So she determined she's going to read from the beginning of the Bible. She wants this mercy, and she intended to read it through. She continued thus until Thursday, and then there was a sudden alteration by a great increase of her concern and an extraordinary sense of her own sinfulness, particularly the sinfulness of her nature and wickedness of her heart. This came upon her, as she expressed it, as a flash of lightning, and struck her into an exceeding terror, upon which she left off reading the Bible in course as she had begun, and then she turned to the New Testament to see if she could not find some relief for her distressed soul. Her great terror, she said, was that she had sinned against God. Her distress grew more and more for 3 days until she saw nothing but blackness of darkness before her, and her very flesh trembled for fear of God's wrath. She wondered and was astonished at herself that she had been so concerned for her body and applied so often to physicians to heal that, and had neglected her soul. Her sinfulness appeared with a very awful aspect to her, especially in three things. One, her original sin, and her sin in murmuring at God's providence, and the weakness and affliction she had been under, and a lack of duty to parents, though others had looked upon her to excel in dutifulness. On Saturday, she was so earnestly engaged in reading the Bible and other books that she continued in it, searching for something to relieve her till her eyes were so dim that she could not know the letters. She could no longer read them. She's so filled with emotion. While she was thus engaged in reading, prayer, and other religious exercises, she thought of those words of Christ in which he warns us not to be as the heathen that think they shall be heard for their much speaking, which she said led her to see that she had trusted to her own prayers and religious performances, and now she was put to a nonplus and knew not which way to turn herself or where to seek relief. While her mind was in this posture, her heart, she said, seemed to fly to the pastor for refuge, hoping that he could give her some relief. She came the same day to her brother with the countenance of a person in distress, expostulating with him why he had not told her more of her sinfulness, and earnestly inquiring of him what she should do. She seemed that day to feel in herself an enmity against the Bible, which greatly affrighted her. So her sinfulness, her awareness of it, is increasing more and more. It's increasing from Thursday until Monday. And she didn't know that she was guilty of Adam's sin, and now she's convicted of that. On the Sabbath day, she was so ill that her friend thought it best that she should not go to public worship, of which she seemed very desirous. But when she went to bed on the Sabbath night, she took up a resolution that she would the next morning go to the pastor, hoping to find some relief there. As she awakened on Monday morning, a little before day, she wondered within herself at the easiness and calmness she felt in her mind, which is of that kind she never felt before. As she thought of this, such words as these were in her mind. The words of the Lord are pure words, health to the soul and marrow to the bones. And then these words, the blood of Christ cleanses from all sin, which were accompanied with a lively sense of the excellency of Christ and his sufficiency to satisfy for the sins of the whole world. She then thought of that expression, it is a pleasant thing for the eyes to behold the Son, which words then seemed to her to be very applicable to Jesus Christ. By these things her mind was led into such contemplation and views of Christ as filled her with exceeding joy. Well, Timorous said, what madness has made you and your husband run yourselves into such difficulties? You must have heard what happened to your husband the moment he took his first step on his way as our neighbor. So she's recounting the story of Obstinate and Pliable and Apollyon and Vanity Fair and all of these things. And Christiana just said, don't tempt me, neighbor. I've had a prize put into my hands from which I have a great deal to gain, and would be the greatest of fools if I had the heart to seize the opportunity. And for all you tell me of the troubles I'm likely to meet on the way, far from discouraging me, they actually show me I'm in the right way. The bitter must come before the sweet, and that's what Secret had told her when she wanted Secret to take her and the children immediately. The bitter must come before the sweet, and that will make the sweet even sweeter. So since you haven't come to my house in God's name, I'd like you to leave and not upset me any further. Then Timorous abused her and said to her companion, "Come on, neighbor Mercy, let's leave her to her own devices, since she despises our advice and our company." And I'll leave you with the words of Mercy. And in next study, Lord willing, we'll start to look into Mercy and why she followed Christiana and why it so affected her. She wasn't like Timorous. So Mercy was in a dilemma and could not so easily go along with her neighbor for two reasons. One, her heart ached for Christiana. So she said to herself, "If my neighbor has to go, then I'll go a little way with her and help her." Her heart yearned for her own soul, for what Christiana said had taken hold in her mind. So she said to herself again, "I'll talk some more with this Christiana. And if I find there's truth in life in what she says, I'll be willing to go with her." So she replied to her neighbor, Timorous, "Neighbor, I did come to see Christiana this morning, and since she is, as you see, making her last farewell to this country, I think I'll walk a little way with her on this sunny morning to help her on her way." But she kept her second reason to herself and didn't tell them. Timorous said, "Well, I see you have a mind to fool around too. But be wise and take heed in time. As long as we're out of danger, we're out. But once we're in, we're in." So Mrs. Timorous went back to her house, and Christiana took herself off on her journey. So next week, we will begin with the character Mercy. And I'll pray. We have a different way with another kind of sinner, but the mercy is the same, and it's so rich and free. And may we be refreshed by this again. May it help us to long more to enter into it and to be a calm for us in the coming days of trials, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.